From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Take Netflix as the model of the cool killer companies rising out of the dot-com meltdown of the 90s. Netflix mails you movies on a day's notice. No late fees on returns either. But what beat Blockbuster and Walmart in the DVD rental market was the network in Netflix. Netflix knows the movies, old and new, that your friends, your zip code, are watching, and often knows what you want to see before you do. It models the role of other mavericks in the new marketplace by enlisting outsiders, literally getting customers' heads into their database and virtually ignoring the competition. Among the maverick success stories, Craigslist, for example, HBO, Southwest Airlines, the keys are not technology or even talent. The buzzwords are the architecture of participation, staying in perpetual beta, and get this, open source. You can prospect for gold, literally, on open source principles. Mavericks at Work are next on Open Source.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts Lowell, with master's programs exploring new interdisciplinary approaches to environmental, social, and economic problems. For more information, email resd@uml.edu.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking this hour about bringing the open source philosophy, believe it or not, into the boardroom. In a company like Topcoder, Jack Hughes is the founder and chairman of Topcoder, which is in the international software business, farming out its work worldwide. Jack Hughes, how does Topcoder work?
Hi, Chris.
Welcome. Thank you.
Topcoder is really a global community of software developers that work on the community has three underlying principles, if you will, and it's a place for developers to learn to be educated from each other and from resources outside of what one company could provide. Secondly, it's a place where programmers, developers can play, can compete with each other in contests and learn during the contests and compete really just for the pure entertainment value of it. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, Topcoder provides a venue in which the developers from around the world can create software for primarily, in our case, companies, some nonprofits and so on, but primarily, in our case, companies, large Fortune 500 companies as well as mid-sized companies.
Jack, I wondered when you said it's a community of developers whether that was a polite way of saying nobody gets paid, but obviously they do.
Topcoder is very different in that respect from a lot of communities. There are many people that make a lot of money in Topcoder from a variety of either winning contests or winning development competitions or working on review boards that review various pieces of software, as well as put software together for our clients.
I'd like to hear a practical example. Somebody comes to you with a problem and you, in effect, farm it out.
Sure. What someone comes to us with a problem.
Like what?
Typically, a program application, say they'll want a trading platform, a stock trading platform. So say it's a financial services company of some sort that wants a trading platform that's got some uniqueness to its business. What we will do is go in with a Topcoder employee, which is a project manager. We call them a project manager. They go in, lay out exactly how that project, that piece of software is going to work. They then break it into many pieces, which we call components. Those components are posted out on the internet to our member base, built by the member base, and then put back together.
Posted out. In effect, these are like requests for proposals or you know, bidding jobs, right?
Well,
like you
not
post them
jobs
at City Hall.
They're actually not bidding jobs. We put the work out there and we say, here's what we're willing to pay for it. And then what they do is they submit solutions to those problems.
And who are they?
Programmers from around the world. They may be in Kansas, they may be in China, they may be in India, they may be in Romania. So that they could be from anywhere around the world. Currently, we have about 93,000 members that are in virtually every country in the world.
Wow. 93,000 people look online and see, is there a job I could tackle at the price today?
Exactly. And so you know, not all 93,000 look every time. There's usually a much smaller contingent that do, but it usually ranges in around 20% of our member base that's active at any given point.
And Chris, if I could just jump in for a sec. Hey, Jack, I spent a lot of time getting to know the Top Coder community, and you really, the spirit of both competition and learning on this site and in this community is really incredible. And I had a lot of fun interviewing a bunch of the top coders from China, Poland, so on. The young guy named, they all have screen names, you know. So Wishing Bone is a screen name from a small city or a big city, but not one of the major cities in China. And this guy has earned over the years, I don't know what the number is, I forget, $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 from winning so many of these competitions, which where he comes from is real serious money. And yet what's so interesting is, although the money's super important, what really in my email conversations with him, what really seemed to matter was the sense that he could stay in whatever city he is in China and for the first time ever have an opportunity to test his skills and compete against some of the best programmers in the world without ever having to leave home. And every time you win one of these competitions or compete, you get a score and your ratings tabulate up. And I don't know if it's still 2,200, but when the time I was in interviewing him, if you reached the level of 2,200 points, you were considered, you went red. You were a red member of Top Coder. And it's so funny, this kid in China, and he was so thrilled that he was now red. And I couldn't help thinking to myself, you know, 50 years ago, being red in China meant you were an intense communist. Now it means you're a fantastic software program. And it just shows you how much the world has changed. And what Jack is clicking into here is a real sense of what makes talented people tick. And how you as Top Coder is still kind of a small company in the grand scheme of things. How you can get access to really talented people all over the world if you give them a platform that responds to what makes them tick. And really great people love to keep pushing themselves to develop their skills and keep learning. Really great people love to test their mettle and compete against other really
talented. Where does
the
competition come in? I mean, where does the judgment of who did it best come in, Jack?
There's a variety of venues. Some are what we call algorithm competitions, which are really very short-term competitions, which are wide-scale. They may have thousands of members. We do them for a variety of companies, people that sponsor them, like AOL or Google or whoever. Then there are actual software writing competitions where the software is sort of, I was describing earlier, is destined for some client. Those are typically measured on everything from how well and how fast the piece of software runs and how well it operates, how much load it can take, how accurate it is, right down to how well it's written, how well all of the style points that we measure are actually in the code.
Our own suggest a show mailbox at Open Source sounds like our version of this, but I'm not hearing really what you think of as the open source side of Top Coder, Jack Hughes.
There's a huge open source component to it, which is really the ability to use code. All of our code, at least that's not proprietary to a client, is posted on the site and can be used by any member. And actually can be used by non-members. So there's anyone from the public can come in and download a component or download a solution to a problem, look at it, use it, build upon it, do whatever they will with it. If it's a large commercial company, they need to pay for that in some way, but if it's on a personal use, educational use, or just a playful use basis, it's absolutely free. There's nothing to it. Source code, from our standpoint, is always delivered with the solution, so everyone always has access to exactly what's been written.
That's really key. There's a sense of transparency here where if you're a coder, you see everybody else's code. There's another piece of the competition. You try to break the other guy's code and point out the flaws and so on. But to me, a big part of the open source phenomenon in software in general is a sense that you're both contributing and learning at the same time, because you see the other guy's code and you figure out, well, it really is better than mine and here's why and what can I learn. And a big, big piece of the Top Coder phenomenon, I mean, among these 93,000, many, many thousands never go into these competitions, but they have what they call practice rooms, and they go in and they do interviews with each other. How'd you come up with that, you know, way of writing the code? They post their code and analyze it. This is a global learning community, and there really is a sense of transparency and sharing, and we love to compete, we love to go head to head, but to me, I see it as the end result is tremendous collaboration. The mechanism is the spirit of competition, and the result of that is lots and lots of learning by lots of people. And I think that's, and Jack can speak to it better than I, but I think what really gets people to stick with this and remain in the community is that, man, this is the best way to learn as a software programmer I've ever seen. And I think that spirit of...
But let me ask you, there is in that open source, shall we say, the Linux community, an anti-proprietary bias, not exactly an anti-commercial bias, but I wonder, Jack Hughes, is there a backlash in sort of Linux world to your commercial application of these open source ideas?
No, we just haven't experienced anything like that. I think that, or at least I would hope, that the Linux community and the open source community in general really looks at TopCoder as a complementary mechanism to software. I'm not a big believer in that. The open source community is, as you say, that they're anti-commercial. TopCoder is certainly a commercial entity, and I think people are where things are open and where source code's available, where learning is available. I think the open source community in general much embraces that.
You know, it must be cheaper to make software the open source in the TopCoder way, but I wonder who is reaping the benefit here.
Oh, what we've certainly hoped to build as a company is something that really creates a win-win situation for both developer and the user of software. We feel that developers, to the extent that they increase their skills and to the extent that they want to increase their skills, should be given every opportunity to do that and should be able to be remunerated commensurately.
But isn't part of the benefit, Jack, that you're speaking about the lower wage rates in Beijing or Sofia, and they're taking on these jobs on spec in a way?
Yeah, what's sort of funny about that, though, is Bill mentioned Wishing Bone at this point is well north of $100,000 in terms of what he's made over the last few years with TopCoder. The way we look at it is we pay the same amount of money whether the developer is based in New York City in Manhattan or is based in China. So it's really pay commensurate with the value that's provided to the ultimate end user.
Interesting. I'm still speculating, though, that Wishing Bone is the kid who made it to the NBA, and he's one of thousands. And that $100,000 would cost you an awful lot more in Silicon Valley, right?
It may. We have plenty of members that compete from Silicon Valley and from, you know, high cost areas of the U.S. and they do it for a variety of reasons. We do have incentive programs, if I can call them that, that span much more than just who the top echelon is. We're really looking to make it so that developers who can deliver real value can make a good living at this, and that certainly takes some time. Along with, you know, TopCoder is only a 5-year-old company, so it's relatively new. But certainly, the amount of money that we put out in the community is millions of dollars at this point. So it's not chicken feed.
Fair enough,
and it's growing rapidly.
We're talking about Mavericks at Work in the title of our pal Bill Taylor's new book about sort of innovative business after the dot-com bubble. Rob McEwen is clearly another one at Goldcorp. Rob McEwen, welcome. You're the Canadian gold miner who's figured out an open-source way to figure out where precious metals are. Tell us about it. Tell us about the Goldcorp challenge.
Chris, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, I was on a speakerphone, so I'm just hoping it doesn't come across that way.
No, it doesn't.
The Goldcorp Challenge was a way to enlist the world in geologists and miners around the world in in an attempt to find another 6 million ounces of gold at the bottom of our mine. And I had gone into that. I had conducted some brainstorming amongst our geologists and asked them, how big is this deposit and how long would it take us to determine that? And they came back, and their answer to both those questions was, we don't know. And I found that very unsatisfactory. So I suggested we convene a brainstorming session and brought all of our geologists in, and I said, I'd like to hear all of the suggestions that each of you have made that have been shot down by your superiors. I'd like to hear all your favorite ideas that you haven't shared with anybody. And we started this process off. We had the head of the exploration group there, and he went through a certain methodology, which was rather stale and uninspiring, and I asked him to sit down and then asked the youngest person in the room to come up and share with the group their ideas. And that set the tone for 2 days, and at the end of it, everybody was very excited by this process.
But at this point, all of these geologists are working for you. They're staff people. Okay.
They were in a room. And so as I went away, I said, we must do this on a larger scale. We should invite geologists who'd retired from the firm. We should ask people who work for the competition. We should ask people that are that work for the government. And as I was carrying this idea around, I then thought, well, you know, on every continent there's a similar geological setting, so there must be expertise there. How do we access it? And then one day I was at a course for a week at MIT on information technology, and they were talking about all the developments, and they started talking about Linux. And at that point, there was this explosion in my head, and I went, there's the template I'm looking for. So I ran back to home after the course and said, we're going to take all of our proprietary data that goes back 50 years. We're going to throw it up on the web. We'll marry it with software to allow us to see it in 2 and 3 dimensions. And we'll ask the world to tell us where in this very exciting discovery we've had we'll find the next 6 million ounces of gold. And for their inputs, they'll have a chance to win prizes totaling $500,000. And I can tell you, it was the most amazing thing that there were 1,400 people from 50 countries that took down a 400 megabyte file. And in came all the tools you would expect to see from geologists. But
talk about
was
disruption. I mean, this is exactly, if I had a gold mine, obviously I'd throw a fence around it and make sure nobody came.
Big fence. It's 55,000 acres.
Yeah, I know. There's
a
very, very big fence. And you're saying exactly the opposite.
Yes.
Everybody in the world take a guess as to, this is wisdom of geological crowds or something.
Well, there was a lot. I mean, the industry just was, they just said, what are you doing? You wouldn't do that. But our head of exploration, I told them, well, take a look at this. What do you think of our discovery? And at that point, it was a very exciting discovery. And he said, well, it's a world-class discovery. And I said, well, if we take all of our geological data and we put it up on the web and attach your name to it and distribute it to every mining school in the world, what would that do for your career? Would it hurt it? And he went, no. and then it just caught, and everybody went, this is a neat idea. I called up a professor emeritus of geology at one of the top schools in the country and said, I need some help. I'm looking to assemble a panel of judges for a contest, and here's how it works. Would you consider working with me on this? And I said, I'll call you back in a couple of days after you've had a chance to think about it. Well, he called me back the next morning. He said, I did not sleep 5 minutes last night. This is the most exciting idea I've heard in the last 25 years in geology. And he said, I'd love to work with you, and I know just the people that could be the judges. And so we picked them from...
Robbie Coote, I hear the process here, and it's very exciting. This is open source gold mining, but what were the results?
Well, we selected 25 semifinalists and then selected 3 finalists out of that. We found the 6 million ounces of gold, so that was good. Hmm. And they're looking for the next 6 million today. It was a tremendous way of getting third-party validation of our methodology and our estimates of reserves or the amount of gold we could mine. It was a great talent hunt. We hired 10 of the people that came through the system. It pushed Goldcorp onto the world stage and put us forward as being viewed as a very innovative company, a place where talented people want to work. And it set about a dramatic shift in attitude about what
I get
is possible.
I get it. We're going to take a short break, Robin Kuhn, but we'll be back. We're talking about the new Mavericks at work, in Bill Taylor's words. We'll be back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about business in the 21st century and the new models of ultra-cool companies. Robert McEwen is talking about finding gold, 6 million ounces, the open source way. Does it work, Robert McEwen, if everybody does it?
I think it. Yes, short answer.
Were you just the first to figure it out? Where does the model go from here is my question.
It can go many places. I'd say you start looking at businesses differently. You start thinking, what is the fundamental the fundamental assumption that's unquestioned by everybody in the industry? Shift your perspective a few degrees, and you generate new alternatives.
What was the old assumption? What's the new one in the gold game?
The old assumption was that you have proprietary data. It's probably your next to owning the property, the most valuable asset you have. You never give it away. You never share it unless you're doing it with letters of confidentiality and with big penalties if you disclose or act in a way that's adverse to the owner of the property, like buying the land around it or taking over the company.
And the new assumption?
The new assumption is share it and you'll find more than you were expecting.
Cast your bread upon the waters, right?
To me, the lesson here, and this is really an arresting example and one of my favorite examples in the book, but to me, the couple things are going on. First of all, Bill Joy once said that from Sun Microsystems once said 99.9% of the smart people in the world will never work for your company. It's just a mathematical fact of life, right? Nobody's that big. The world today is filled with so many brilliant people in so many different fields, and most of them will never work for your company. But we live in a world, thanks to the internet, where people don't have to work for you in order to work with you. And if you figure out a way, as Rob McEwen has, as Jack Hughes has, to invite brilliant people, wherever they may be, to play with your company, contribute a little bit of your brain power, become part of what you're trying to do, it's amazing what you can unleash. And one thing Rob didn't say is the single best drilling strategy for his mine came from a couple of guys in Australia. They had never worked with Rob. I'm not sure they'd ever been to Canada before. And in fact, they weren't even in the gold mining business. They were in the oil and gas business. And they had this really powerful software to analyze oil and gas deposits. But they thought that it could work in the gold mining industry as well. So they took this software and they borrowed money, refinanced their house to rewrite it to work on Rob's data. So it's not just lots of smart people working with you, but people from all different walks of life contributing and looking at things with fresh eyes. And to me, that is the real important piece of the new logic of innovation.
We love the idea, and we try to practice it at open source, not in a commercial way, but we're always asking people to help us do the work. And they do.
Yeah.
The question is, when you commercialize it, and gold companies are supposed to make money, what do you owe the people who helped you, who shared their expertise, their curiosity, their interest?
Rob, can I answer on your behalf, and then you can jump in? Because the thing that struck me most about Rob's leadership style in general and the Goldcorp challenge in particular is how generous he was, not just with the, let's call them the 10 finalists, but with his competition in the industry. They had this challenge. They had the 10 finalists. They had the winners. The winners got the big bucks kind of deal. But Rob, at the annual big gold mining convention there is every year, Rob took the 10 finalists, flew them all to Canada, said, "We're having everybody in the industry is here. I am going to share all these people with you, my competition. I'm going to put them on stage. You're going to meet them. You're going to learn about them. They're going to show you what they did." And the theory that he was going to make these 10 winning geologists, the 10 finalists, superstars in the business, and then tell his competition, "Look, I'm not going to keep these people for myself. Their contributions have made this company fabulously successful. I want to share them with you. And so there was a certain generosity of spirit in the same way that he shared the data. He also shared the expertise. I'm not going to lock these people in a room and never let anybody else have access to them. And what's
amazing, how about give them health benefits?
But a lot of them came from other countries where there's already healthcare systems that aren't requiring private benefits, so it works okay. But and what's amazing to me, you said, what happens when everybody does business this way? What amazes me about the Goldcorp challenge is not a single other company in the gold business copied it. How hard would it be to just copy it? If he did it, we can do it. But it's too disruptive. It's too outside the standard mindset. And so the worry, the question isn't what happens when everybody copies these innovative ideas. The question for me is, where the hell is everybody else? Why aren't they learning from this stuff?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, especially in the news and information game. I mean, why isn't the New York Times using the internet to put its readers to work to inform each other? They've got the best base, best informed, most connected, powerful, you know, readers in the world, but they don't contribute to the base of information.
It's funny,
and I don't get it.
Yeah, the big media companies still say the game is, okay, using the internet for new ways to push ideas from the inside out. They still have all the expertise, but rather than getting on the printed paper, we'll have some of our writers do blogs. To me, the new logic of innovation is from the bottom up and the outside in. And there is so much distributed brain power in the world. And maybe it was always thus, but you've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of Chinese and Indians getting PhDs every year. As Americans, we can look and say, oh my God, they're going to clean our clock. It's a competitive challenge. Or you say, my goodness, all these brilliant people are out there. We can connect with them through the internet. Let's create companies that smart people want to do business with. I mean, to me, the challenge for a leader today is not, are you the smartest guy or woman in the room? It's, are you the kind of leader that other smart people want to rally around, play with, brainstorm with, have? And it means you have to conduct yourself as a company and a leader with a very different style.
I love it. Speaking of mavericks at work, Peter Van Stolk started something called Jones Soda, which rather literally outsources the branding of the product. Peter Van Stolk, explain Jones Soda.
Jones Soda is a beverage company. We make sodas, but we compete with very large companies.
Like Pepsi or Coke, I suppose. Nantucket
and
Nectars.
Yeah, well, sort of large companies. And what we've done from the start is we realized that the world doesn't need another soda. So that was our philosophical point of view coming into it. And therefore, we had to change the game. And from the start, we've allowed consumers to give us their photos, and we put their name and photo on the bottle. We put their quotes under their cap. We allow them to identify flavors that they want to play with, and we really allow them to have a brand and make it their brand. And that's what we
do. How does a soda drinker put his photograph or, you know, his himself or herself or pictures they took on your bottle?
Well, the brand was built around that. It's a window. So we, in our label is basically a window frame, and the frame, we're the frame, and the photos are the pictures. And the consumers send us the pictures. And if we like your photo is what we started 10 years ago. We had this little quote on the bottle that said, if we like your photo, we'll put it on a bottle. And from that, we've received over 4 million photos. There were 900,000 photos on our website. People get fired up when they see their photo on a bottle.
You're giving up control in a certain way.
Sure. And that's imperative because that's the key to why we do it. If you don't give up control, then you're really not that special. You're just trying to sort of jam it in what you want. And I don't think that's going to work in today's society where the kids that we deal with, they've grown up on television. They know how to turn a TV flicker faster than you and I do. And they need to have that ownership, and they need to have that sense of control. And I think that's the framework of what I'm being listening to, is that you do give up some control, but then you allow people to be really creative and really excited and really passionate about your brand.
Sounds like Joe Trippi talking about the end of command and control in political campaigns, except Bush, I mean, Kerry beat his candidate, Dean, and George Bush, I mean, with Mr. Command and Control, Karl Rove, at his side, beat John Kerry. I mean, how do we know this works?
You know, you, I don't know if you, I don't know how you know it works. It works for Jones, and I can't say that it wouldn't work for anybody else. I think it's common sense, though. I think sooner or later, you look at the average consumer's hearing 3 million or 1 million plus marketing messages a year. That translates into about 3,000 marketing messages a day or over that, and no one really cares anymore. And so brands aren't relevant. So I think as there's more television stations coming on, and there's more magazines out there, and there's more this, and there's more that, I think it's just the next evolution of making brands relevant. And that's what I think. And, you know, it doesn't really matter what I think, because it doesn't matter.
So in a world where nobody needs a new soda, how did Jones Soda, the ante company, become a very big deal? And how big are you at this point?
Last year's revenues were roughly $35
million. Million?
Yeah. So it's relatively small. We sell 16 million bottles, and we're growing every year, and, you know, we do different things. But I think our approach has been very, very focused at that we listen to our consumers. We understand who we are. We don't take ourselves too seriously, you know, and that's very important. And we respect what they have to say from their perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the challenging thing. And when you talk about giving up control, by allowing someone to communicate to you and listen from their perspective, that's really powerful versus listening from your own perspective.
Our blogger-in-chief, Brendan Greeley, who's always listening to other perspectives, has a word.
Thousands of Indians are auditioning for my job right now. John Garfunkel is a constant companion on the blog. He writes, "The open source movement says that the user can be the implementer, but the open governance movement has a much wider appeal. That is, while I'm a shareholder in and a customer of ExxonMobil, there's very little I can do to influence this firm. I don't know enough about oil, but I do want open governance, whether it's the petroleum industry or the Metro Boston Transit Authority." So it's a question for Peter Van Stalk. You've been talking about ownership and control of the brand, but would you open up your board meetings to the same type of public input?
Sure. You know, actually, we're going to do a contest where they can actually become the CEO for the day. And we've done that with kids, and they've come in and they've given me ideas. And, yeah, it's really important. You know, again, you don't have to – we're not the smartest people on the block. In fact, we're pretty dumb. Hmm. I think the only thing that we do is we listen well, and that's all we do.
Jack Hughes, do your coders – sort of shape the brand, mark the brand, mark the company?
Absolutely.
For example?
The community is hugely influential in what types of contests we run, what type of content we run, and frankly, the community builds all of the software that TopCoder itself is run on. So it's they're hugely influential in both how the company is run and what direction it takes, as well as the implementation of what those strategies are.
Bill Taylor, I wonder, is the sort of new business culture coming back, which was so, I mean, you could feel it in the air. Everybody in the world was writing a business plan,
right?
6, 8, 10 years ago,
which was part of the problem.
Yeah,
we didn't. When there was a 13th online pet food store, you knew that something had run a bit amok, I think.
But are we back yet? When do we get back?
I mean,
with the stock market, interestingly, I mean, pushing
the
a
Dow
new high.
Approaching a record high. Yeah, I think, much to my delight, because it's been a sort of very long period for me, but I think we are, as a business culture, I think that's a key point. It's really not about. Dollars and cents in the stock market, as John Maynard Keynes said, the animal spirits that animate the economy and the society. And I think the business culture, after a very long 5 years of scandal and criminality and ethical misconduct and kind of business at its worst, I think people are rediscovering the sense that you can use the format of the company as a great way to do innovation, social progress, have a lot of fun, do work that means a lot to you. In a sense, it's rediscovering some of the things that we all learned in the 90s before the whole between all the technology and all the money, it kind of got away from us. But I think the key difference, and I hope your listeners hear it in the three maverick characters we have on the show today, a big piece of the new business sensibility, and I think a big piece of the new leadership sensibility is what I think of as personal strength and conviction, but genuine intellectual humility. And in each of these cases, the CEOs are saying, I don't think I'm the smartest guy at my company. I don't think I'm the smartest person in my industry. The mantra we use in the book is nobody is as smart as everybody. If you as a leader, you as a company, can create conditions where lots of really smart people want to be part of what you're doing and want to work with you, you can unearth all kinds of opportunities, unleash all sorts of energy, generate all sorts of great results that the old school Donald Trump, know-it-all CEO, kind of boardroom scandal of the sort we're seeing at HP just doesn't, the kind of imperial CEO, I think the imperial CEO, other than in the most retrograde parts of the economy, is once and for all done with. And the voices you're hearing on the program today are CEOs who have really strong values and commitments, but have genuine intellectual humility as well. I think that's a really key shift in the business zeitgeist, if you will.
Jack Hughes, you want to proclaim your own humility here? Or do you want to admit that there are moments when you do think you're the smartest guy in your game? And I suspect you...
I know I'm not the smartest guy in this room because I'm in the room with Chris Lydon.
Wrong again. But Jack, are there limits on this Bill Taylor euphoria, which we love but we have to fight?
Yeah, there probably are, but it's just that, at least from my perspective, the horizon is so wide open that the things that Bill is talking about as outlined in his book, I think have huge implications for business going forward, not just business but society in general. And I think they can all be very positive. To answer the question about how smart I am, the way I sort of walk in each day is looking at the number of members we have and pretty much figuring that the vast majority, almost all, are probably smarter than I am. So there's a fair amount of humility that
Peter Van Stoek, I wonder, can you out humble him?
No.
Can I just ask Bill Taylor a final question in a minute? What is it about HBO, The Soprano, cable network, that somehow symbolizes all of this?
Well, the reason we have a big chunk of the book on HBO, and we include it for a couple of reasons. First of all, we didn't want to give readers the impression that this idea of competing on values and so on is like this politically correct sort of thing, and it's sort of the Ben and Jerry's economy, and it's the do-gooder approach to business. It's not about being populist or do-gooder. It's about being a genuine original in whatever field you're in. In the last 20 years, television as an industry is probably more devoid of new ideas than any sector of the economy you can imagine. I mean, it's a place where mimicry is what guides everything. And HBO, 20 years ago, made the decision that we are going to fundamentally change the game in the nature of programming, how you approach creativity, how do you deal with the writers and the producers and so on. And we see the results on the small screen every day. And so the power of disruptive thinking in a famously copycat industry is very appealing.
Bless you, Bill Taylor, and thank you for coming back with Mavericks at Work. Thank you, Jack Hughes, Robert McEwen, and Peter Van Stoek. You can keep talking about the new business world. You can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Landmine Survivors Network, offering health, opportunities, and rights to mine victims worldwide. www.landminesurvivors.org. Radio Open Source is hosted by Contegix, contegix.com. The show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Murs, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton, with help from Rob Keir. Robin Moore was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.